Hi and welcome to Blockchain Beat. My name is Ana Paula Picasso. And did you know that malaria kills over 400,000 people per year globally? This episode will be about how a project in Uganda is reaching underserved areas where testing for malaria can be challenging and having the diagnosis early can be a matter of life or death. So I invited Dr. Lito Michaela, a lecturer at the University of Glasgow in the School of Computing Science focused on IoT. She's involved in the project, and we talk about how they chose blockchain to store and share the data of the malaria test results and the challenges for blockchain adoption in the healthcare system.
I think this is because blockchain has only just in the recent years started to be used in medical applications. It has been traditionally used in other domains, financial mostly. Recently, it's been, finding applications in other domains like the medical domain.
In the second part, I selected some clips from an interview with Professor John Cooper and Dr. Julien Rebaud from the Bioengineering School at University of Glasgow. We talked about how the project came about, the technology behind the test, and how smartphones are used as a power source providing electricity to process the test. And if you want to listen to the second part in full, just head to my other podcast, Emerging Markets Today. All the links are in the show notes, and follow this podcast in your favorite podcast platform. Hi, Lito, and welcome to Blockchain Beat. I'm here with Dr. Lito Michaela. We're going to talk about the project in Uganda that she's involved with. It's a project for underserved areas and how blockchain is being used to share and store the data of malaria test results. So it's going to be all about healthcare, and how blockchain or how the aspects of blockchain are being used. So Lito, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks. I'm Lito Michaela. I'm a lecturer at the University of Glasgow in the School of Computing Science. And my research is on smart monitoring small devices, which we tend to call Internet of Things these days. Mm-hmm. And my focus is particularly on how we use the data they collect. How do we make sure we can trust whatever these devices are recording? How can we improve privacy protection, security, and ethical use of these devices? So my research revolves around those softer topics, if you like.
I see. Yeah. That also... one of the reasons I invite you here is to talk about blockchain. I just had a conversation with Professor John and Julien about how you guys are using smartphones to diagnose malaria in Uganda. And the other part that really caught my attention in the article was about the use of blockchain. Even if you're not too familiar with the blockchain technologies, just stick around. We're not getting too technical. So we're just going to talk a little bit about how blockchain is used to share the data of the data or the results of those tests. So Lito, why did you guys choose blockchain?
Right, thanks for the question. Basically, the choice was to improve, as I was saying before, trust and security. Blockchain offers some really interesting features. Basically, you can securely transfer the data, but also you can go back and check that the data you have now is the same as the data that was initially collected.
So am I right to think that you guys chose blockchain because of the immutability aspect?
That's exactly what it is. And at the same time, you can trace who generated this data, when, and trace it all back to the beginning. So, for example, if a malaria test was taken by a specific medical professional at a specific location, this can be traced back to the date that this data was first collected.
Yeah, that's definitely very useful. But what is the biggest challenge for the blockchain adoption in modern healthcare systems?
This is very useful in modern healthcare systems because one of the blockers, if you like, in the adoption of this technology is that medical professionals do not trust that the technology has not been hacked, has not been tampered with. And so it offers, if you like, a secure data collection and data transfer backbone upon which then you can start building intelligence. So if you can know that your data is trustworthy, you can build intelligence that is also trustworthy as a result. I hope I've answered your question.
Of course you did, yeah. So I'm kind of not surprised, but it's interesting to see that the medical bodies, they still not too familiar. They are not too familiar with the aspect of immutability or blockchain and also traceability, because then you can, everything can be traced.
Yeah, I think this is because blockchain has only just in the recent years started to be used in medical applications. It has been traditionally used in other domains, financial mostly. Recently, it's been, you know, finding applications in other domains like the medical domain, like the power electronics, so as in use of power kind of domain. So now more people are starting to get used to the idea. But you will find that the healthcare systems are slow bodies to adopt chains.
Exactly. Yeah. People mostly associate blockchain with cryptocurrencies, with investments, but the technology can be applied with other, in other aspects like healthcare. So having said that, do you see any flaws or any shortcomings, some areas that need more research for blockchain to be used on healthcare data?
Still areas of research that need to grow further around blockchain to make sure that we can use it and integrate it into big data type of systems. For example, blockchain is not designed to hold hordes and hordes of data like a medical healthcare system would generate. So there are still active areas of research around how best to integrate it. But our approach was one example of how it can be done using the benefits of blockchain transiently when data is being in transfer, and then using the benefits of a backbone like a cloud database, for example, to store all of this information more permanently. And investigating other directions of how to best integrate that with existing systems that are used in sub-Saharan African countries. If I'm not getting too technical now, maybe.
Actually, that would bring to my next question. How is it going there? Are you guys seeing the results with the use of blockchain, like streamlining and communication improvement?
Yes, I think there are some beneficial results shown in the in our Nature article as well, where you can see that there are no huge delays when data is uploaded to the network, but also you can see the benefit of delay tolerance. So people could be collecting loads and loads of tests locally, but they don't have any internet access while they are doing that. And then as they move closer to a location where there is internet access, then all the data is uploaded at once to the network. And we have recorded how long it takes to do that. And I definitely need to say thanks to our very skilled PhD students for doing this, because it took some interesting experimental work to verify that this is the case.
And then, Lito, can you talk me through like the chain of events for this project in Uganda? Let's say the test for malaria has been done. Let's say there was a positive, positive marker for malaria. And then you have to communicate this result to someone. How would be the chain of events? And where blockchain plays a part in this?
The way that the application is designed, it processes the information locally on the mobile phone and provides a result of a positive or a negative marker, whatever it is, directly on the spot to the healthcare provider, whoever it is, maybe the medical professional on site, or the nurse, or whoever is handling the device. And for that to happen, it takes a few minutes. So the patient can be around for that time and wait to get the result immediately. Now, blockchain plays a role after that. When the medical professional sends the test and the result to the cloud, which then can be communicated to the bigger healthcare system. And then the interest is in finding out things like how the disease progresses in a population, making forecasting for how best to deal with potential hot points where they expect the disease to grow faster, or how best to plan for things like stock, medication availability, these kinds of things. So blockchain plays a role after, if you like, the diagnosis is done, and providing this information to the cloud so bigger analytics can take place. But also blockchain plays a role throughout for, as we said, the traceability and immutability of the data itself. Because previously, somebody would have to take a test sample on site, send this sample in a lab somewhere with a paper form, then that test would have to take, a few days to be processed, and then the result would have to come back on some sort of paper form again, so the patient could be notified. So if you like, we've taken all this potential for human error out of the equation. We've taken all this manual processing out of the equation. So technically, we've taken a process that takes a few days and made it last a few minutes, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. And takes away, like you said, the potential of human error.
I mean, imagine somebody going around with paper forms, a paper form falls out, or a sample is mislabeled or attached to the wrong paper form. There's huge potential for human error in the process.
Especially in healthcare, it'd be very dangerous. The consequences could be very dangerous. And I still think the technology is very underused in other aspects, especially in healthcare as well. But that will change. Hopefully, they will change in the next few years, Lito.
So, I mean, definitely the research is heading in that direction. There's a few people in different universities looking at the potential of blockchain for healthcare applications. Our article is one of the kind of pioneers in demonstrating this working in real field tests, but there is definite keen interest from the research community. So hopefully we'll see commercialization efforts spinning out of that.
Yeah. And I think the emerging markets would be in the forefront of this application, blockchain healthcare. Well, Lito, thank you very much for the explanation. And I really hope to have you back here to record a full episode so we can dive deep into blockchain for healthcare.
Thank you. Thanks, Anna, for your invitation.
Thank you, Lito.
Bye.
Bye. I have here Dr. Julien Rebaud. Hi, Julien.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me.
And Professor John Cooper.
Hi, Anna. It's a great pleasure to take part in this podcast.
Your article on the conversation called How We Use Smartphones to Test for Malaria, Lessons from Uganda. So it kind of blew my mind. I also want to give a quick shout out for the guys from The Conversation. They have a very good podcast as well called The Conversation Weekly. So you guys can go and check it out. And so, yeah, so I was reading through the article and some of the things just blew my mind, how you know, about your project. But first, I want to talk a little bit about malaria, because for me, I'm from Brazil originally, and I was under the impression that malaria, and especially people dying from malaria, was a thing of the past. But it doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
I mean, malaria is obviously a disease that's prevalent through a greater part of the southern hemisphere, and particularly prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. So the countries that lie at or below the equator in Africa. And for many years, actually, there have been technological and social science interventions which have tried to reduce the prevalence of malaria. And most notable, I suppose, is the insecticide-coated bed netting programs. And in fact, up until about 6 or 7 years ago, malaria was decreasing pretty well globally. And there has been a change, and that was first noted, I think, in about 2018, with an upturn in the rates of or the prevalence of malaria in 13 countries, and this has continued. And there are a number of reasons for it, actually, and they are associated with the availability of diagnostics as one aspect,
right.
And also some quite surprising data which is coming out about comorbidities, so sort of the interaction between different diseases. And, for example, as we've seen changes in lifestyle, work.
Yeah, and that brings me to my next question. And when and how did the origami testing come about? And I really like the name origami. Could you just explain a little bit why do you guys call this test origami testing?
We shall do a one-to-one, and I can answer this question. The idea of origami, we're familiar with the paper figures that people can make with folding paper.
Yes, exactly.
Very elaborate shapes, and that is origami. And so in our hands, origami is much less artistic, but it's still about folding paper. And the idea of folding paper in the context of an assay or a diagnostic test is to answer John's point or challenge about sample preparation. In order to enable the PCR test, which is highly complex, one needs to extract the biomarkers from the sample to get rid of all the contaminants, so to speak, of the reactions that are present in a normal sample of blood. And in order to do that, usually people use a very well catered lab with pipettes and centrifuges, etc., which we don't have in rural settings in Uganda, for example. And so the folding is this idea that if you have paper that is wet on one side and dry on another side, if you fold them together, then the content of the liquid is going to be transferred and from one side of the paper to another. Now imagine that if on the two sides you've got different reagents, you're able to transfer the content of the paper onto different reaction sites, so to speak. And so you're able to use the paper as a valve by simply folding it. And this mm-hmm. is wicking in exactly the same way as you would wipe a coffee stain on a table when you drop your coffee cup. The coffee wets the paper, and so we're able to carry the liquid through the paper in a very well controlled fashion by organizing it and manufacturing it in a way that parts of it is hydrophilic, and so it likes water, and the water can flow as wicking, and parts of it is hydrophobic, and the water does not flow. And so by doing that, we're able to create these networks of channels and wells and areas where reagents are stored to run the reaction in a very precise and determined order. Right? So it's very similar to a cooking recipe. You need to be able to perform reactions in a specific order at a specific time. And by treating the paper in this way and folding it, we're able to do that in a very simple and low-cost fashion.
And also going back a little bit back to the testing itself, I want to talk about smartphones. So another part of the article read about it was a mobile phone-based digital support. So it's very interesting how you guys explain that on the article. I'm just going to read out a little bit for the people that haven't read it. The smartphone is paired with a 3D printed stand containing a simple heating element. The phone provides the battery power to run the DNA-based assay. The app controls the temperature of the origami test. For me, this was the best part. Who came up with this idea? Was this something you guys seen before and applied to that, or something that you came out to yourselves?
So the idea of the smartphone is we have to be humble on this. Using smartphones in diagnostics or in rural areas is not something new. And actually, in Uganda, smartphones are ubiquitous. Lots and lots of people have smartphones. But where there was a little bit of let's say inventivity is the fact that the reaction that we use, so the kind of chemistry for the test requires heat, usually that heat is given out by a bath or a heat block, something that plugs into the mains, and in these villages and settings there is no really mains electricity, and so mm-hmm. we had to come up with a better way of doing this, and we explored a lot of different ways, and actually there are a few that can be possible. For example, using a stove with hot water works very well. It's just a little bit more difficult to control. And so we thought that actually the phone is a source of energy. It's got a battery, and that battery can power a system. And so we then went down this road of using the phone as a power source, not really to use it as an intelligent system, but simply as a power source and a control system for the temperature. And that worked very well. But when we go in Uganda to do these studies, it's always, as John has mentioned, in partnership with researchers over there and support staff from the Ministry of Health as well. Eventually, we would like these assays and these tests to be used by the stakeholders in Uganda, and they have to be able to use them without a PhD. And so when we were first looking at this, the test, although it is easy to interpret, actually has multiplexed outputs. And in order to say what's happening in the patient or what to do with the patient after what treatment to recommend, the decision can become quite complex. And so now we had the phone for heating, and we definitely thought, well, actually the phone is also an intelligent system, and it could be used to help in terms of the interpretation of the results of the test. So it could help to run the test and control the test, but it could also help to support the decision that someone has to make in terms of treatment. And that started a lot of work in artificial intelligence in analyzing images completely automatically to provide that decision support from the cloud as well as an edge computing system in the phone itself.